Welcome, everybody. I am Phil. This is Chuck Wood, who has taught me everything I know. First and foremost, I want you to recognize that I'm not going to have Bible verses by every slide and everything I say. And, you know, I could, because you can put Bible verses by anything you want to. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just being honest. I don't feel like in this session I need to biblify, as I made up that word, by the way, by saying, oh, yeah, I got to make sure I got a scriptural reference here. But understand that when we, and I say we in Navigator Leadership, have developed strategy and processed on how to move forward, we've always, first and foremost, depended on the leading of God through the scripture and prayer. So when I talk about these things, it's kind of like a secular application into our environment. But at the same time, God has created everything. So when we talk about understanding how to process a movement in a strategic way, we recognize that what we're doing is understanding how God has led us and how the wisdom that God has given us has helped us understand how to move to a good future. So, important consideration for this time today is that last night, I don't know about you, but it just killed me. I mean, that was brutal. I mean, I cannot sit while somebody else is talking for 90 minutes. I just can't do it. So I don't think you can either. So the point I'm making here is this is a conversational event. And so what I want to do is to give you the freedom to say it when it comes up, you know, as long as it's somewhere in the ballpark. It doesn't have to be in the infield. It's just being in the ballpark. What I was saying about context here is a context that I'd like us to think about this process in is the changing Navigator mission, movement, and organization. You may, in fact, have a few questions, so just say, wait, what the heck are you talking about here? So, but the context of talking about strategic change and leading strategic change is going to be in this context of how the Navigator mission, movement, and ministry has changed over the years, and how we have been leading that change, or how this change has been led to some degree or another. And particularly, I'm going to talk about the military mission, because that's what I know more about and what I've had more involvement in. But it also has to do with the greater Navigator organization, at least as it concerns the U.S. Navigators. So, a little background. How many of you were around the Navigators in the 70s? Some of you were. I can just tell because you got gray hair. Or you don't have hair, as the case may be. Well, what happened in the 70s, Mike Darnell and I were working on a campus. And my goodness, we led people to Christ every week. You know, I'd go out in the dorms and Mike and his guys would be praying, and then his guys and go out in the dorms, and we'd be praying. We'd be leading people. We led people to Christ every single week. Wasn't this heaven, Mike? It was heaven, wasn't it? But guess what began to happen as the 70s ended, and we began to get into the 80s, and then into the 90s. Come on in.
You got any more room?
Do we have any more room? We do. We do.
We had to climb up pretty high to get here.
I know. Pam, you're going to have to sit right here.
I think my husband's sitting.
Oh, your husband's sitting there. There's a chair right there. Well, I just don't. Yeah, you can. You can sit here and there. I just don't want to get your head into the.
Oh, I got you.
Into
oh,
the.
Be like you always used to do.
Where's my tie? Where's my tie? I don't. I'm seeing your head, Pam. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So, we're leading a bunch of people to Christ in the 70s. We're discipling like crazy. And then we get into the 80s, and as Mike says, this curve begins to flatten out. And then, worse, what happens? 90s. So, how do you explain that?
Paradigm shift.
Good. Keep going, Penny.
The culture actually shifted, and truth became relative.
Yeah.
Good job,
good job. Particularly on campuses, you had a shift in generation. A generation had a worldview back in the 70s that made it quite simple. Now, I want to just add that the Spirit of God was going on in the 70s. So, in certain ways, the impact of the Vietnam War had a tremendous impact. Y'all keep coming. You didn't sign up. If you didn't sign up, I'm sorry, can't come in. come on in. You may. Let's see. Yeah. Just, you got to lean back if you sit there. No, actually, you'll be all right there. So, what was happening is... this Vietnam generation, who I am one of those, began to seek answers in life. And part of it was distrust and disillusionment, which created the question, what is this all about? My own testimony was, growing up in a church background, I didn't know Christ. And so when I got back from Vietnam, I was very disillusioned. And long story short, as I began to ask questions, and as I asked the questions, I discovered there was only one place that there were any answers. And where was that? In the Bible. Exactly right. Now, in looking at my own life experience, one of the things that you could say is, well, I grew up in a church environment, and even though I had kind of rejected it, guess what was still going on in my head? There was still a mental map there. A mental map that said, you know, yeah, the Bible really might have something to say to me if I decided to read it and to study it. So as I began to read and study, guess who I discovered? Jesus. The living Jesus. It's kind of ironic. Mike Darnell was helping me move out of this old house I had lived in at the time I came to Christ. And, Mike, you don't have to tell all the story on that, but...
You got your own history, right?
Yeah. What I saw, you know, I'd lived in an upstairs of this old house and, you know, typical mattress on the floor. And every night I'd pray and read my Bible. And, you know, as we were moving, I looked up and there was a picture way up on the wall. One about like that. And guess what it was? Picture of Jesus, or it's supposed to be a representation of Jesus. You know, all that time I'm praying and reading the Bible, you know, there's a symbol or a sense of God's hand right there in my life. So I share that story to describe the context of where we were. And so as we moved into ministry, you know, we knew how to do certain things and we knew how to do them well. We had great training on how to ask people two questions. And once we asked those people those two questions, we had great training on how to get them to pray. Now, when we were doing evangelism out in the dorms, I had gotten so famous out there that guys would see me coming and they'd be slamming doors. Slamming doors. And, you know, eventually I'd find a door that would actually open and go in and share Christ. I was not below kicking it down. That's right. So anyway, my point in all that is the Navigators essentially, in my entree into ministry with the Navigators was built around this understanding of the way ministry would work. And what happened is ministry began not to work. And it wasn't because we didn't know how to do what we were doing. It was because what we were doing was not working. And so this became a big problem in all of the Navigators. And so through the period of the 80s and the early 90s, lots of thought and lots of action went into developing strategic plans that would help us move towards not only doing the right thing, but knowing how to do the right thing and being willing to do what it took to do the right things. And we'll get into that a little more. So, any questions about the context? Now, how many of you understand the change that's gone on in the military ministry in the last 2 or 3 years? This man does. Some of you. Well, let me just briefly describe that, because that will also be a context for talking about strategic change. When we began the military ministry back in 1990, actually the process of planning began in about 88. What happened was the Navigators realized that in order to put real power into our particular missions, we needed to put leadership specifically towards those missions. And so we developed what we called entities that later became known as missions. So you had the military mission, the collegiate mission, the metro mission, the international student mission, and so forth and so on. Before, there had been geographical regions in which all of these particular diverse ministries or missions would be led by one person. Now, thinking about the way the military operates, can you think of any problems that might cause? You were there, weren't you? Isolation. Because if you were in the Carolinas, you didn't know the people who were in California. And so no matter how good-hearted you might have been, the people who you were involved with in the Carolinas, when they went to California, it was a crapshoot as to whether they would continue in their development in the Navigator mission and vision. So as that happened, there was a military mission that came out of that strategic planning period. And as we began to do certain things in the military, we decided that we would have regions and that all the military would be divided geographically and led that way. Now, a number of years ago, we began to discover that that still had not solved the problem. And so what we wanted was, if this person was led to Christ, let's say at Fort Bragg, and was beginning to get discipled, and then he went to Fort Hood, what would happen to him? We wanted to systematize that process of a person getting involved in our mission and vision, and then moving from this point to this point to this point. Now, how to best accomplish that, and why? Why is that a desire? Why would that be something we'd desire?
Growth cannot happen.
It doesn't happen in isolation.
I just had a guy leave from Ford to Korea, and we hooked him up to, there wasn't any Navigators there, we hooked him up to somebody who needed to help him to grow.
Good, good.
More effective use of resources.
Okay.
You don't have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, at each location.
Good.
If you want your fruit glass, you got to put it in the refrigerator. You got to keep it going.
Okay. Yeah.
Put your fruit to the next person so that it doesn't get rotten in the back.
You got to preserve it, in other words. I think the refrigerator metaphor kind of threw me off there a little bit. Yeah. But that's right. But what is the overwhelming idea that was driving us to make these strategic changes? What is it that we as navigators say, this is what we're about?
Lifetime labors.
Lifetime labors. Now, I've traveled all over, and everywhere I'd go as a supervisor, I'd ask the local guys, I'd say, now, you know, what is the navigators about? And the local guys would always say, to know Christ and to make Him known. That's great. I love that. But guess who in the body of Christ is not about that? Is there anybody in the body of Christ that that's not about? So what is our distinctive in the Holy Catholic body of Christ? Okay, I don't want to confuse you even further. But our distinctive is lifetime laborers. Our distinctive is we want to see not a trickle, but we want to see a flood of lifetime laborers that does what? That impacts the military, the nation, and the nations. Our attempts to plan strategically flow from what the big idea is. The big idea drives our thinking about how to do strategy. So, having all that background, let's just whiz through this. Because honestly, I don't think this is very important. But, yeah. What is strategic? All right, you know the definition for strategic. Here it is. Pertaining to, characterized by, or the nature of strategy. Don't you hate definitions like that? They define themselves by the words that they're supposed to be defining. Important or essential to strategy. Now, this one I like. Of an action as a military operation or a move in a game. Forming an integral part of a stratagem, a strategic move in a game of chess. In the military, it's rendered intended to render the enemy incapable of making war, as by destruction of materials factories. Essential to the conduct of war. Copper is a strategic material. So if you read military history, and I do a little bit of that, you'll discover that when General Marshall, who was the chief of staff during World War II for the U.S. military, was in consultation with Roosevelt and Churchill and the rest of the Allies' powers, it was up to them to create a strategy that did what? Destroy the Axis power, which happened to be Germany and its allies in Japan. So they weren't concerned with flanking movements and defensive positions. What they were concerned about was, how do we trap Germany and all its resources with a pincer movement that would crush Germany? And so that's the reason it was necessary to be in alliance with Russia, which was then the Soviet Union. Our enemy became our friend because it was strategic. It was essential in accomplishing the big idea to see that enemy destroyed. What about strategic planning? You can get any number of these kinds of things off the internet, and I'm just using this as an example of a process that's pretty standard. The first step in strategic planning is to review or develop vision and mission. So I go back to what was taking place, let's say, in the military mission in the late 80s and early 90s. What do you assume that was taking a place in the people who were put responsible for trying to develop the military mission? What was going on? We don't have a military mission. There's not one. There's a U.S. mission of the navigators, and it's divided up by regions. And all of a sudden, the U.S. leadership says, well, now, you military guys, you go decide what you want to do. So what would you surmise that we decided to do? what was the first thing that we would have done? Get a vision statement. Well, unfortunately, we didn't do that, but I'm just being honest. We didn't. Now, part of what the difficulty was is that we did not have a great deal of training or understanding of strategic planning. And what happens in most venues is not this process, but what happens in most venues first is you do what? You define the problem. And from defining the problem, then you begin to go to solutions. Now, that might work, but what this process helps you do is get a better picture of what's happening, and then out of the picture will come a definition of what a better definition of what the problem is, and then out of that, you then begin to work on possible solutions, and then out of those solutions, you use measures to evaluate what's the best solution, which is really how you get to that strategy. So, the second step would be SWOT analysis. That's not SWAT, where you bring in the SWOT team. Though there were times in some of our MLT meetings that probably would have been appropriate. So, they were pretty vociferous, which is a big word. It means loud and occasionally angry. So, but what SWOT analysis is to look at the situation and say, what are our strengths and what are our weaknesses? What are the threats? In other words, what are the things that we have to watch out for and what are our opportunities? So just as so you'll understand where we were at the beginning of this thing we call the military mission, what we did is we began to look at the strengths. What were some of our strengths that you might gather? What's that?
Your people.
Well, yes, exactly.
The Air Force used to say the biggest assets is people.
Good. Another one.
Our God.
I told you we weren't going to get spiritual on this thing. No, exactly right. God was leading us. We felt strongly the pulling and guiding of God and the Holy Spirit as we worked through it. What's another thing? Just think about a group of people who are primarily military people.
Your legacy.
Okay, legacy. Yes. We had all that had happened in the Navigators, really, for a number of decades. What's another one?
Well, we can be fulfilling all the needs of all the bases.
Okay. A driving need. That's over there in part of the opportunity section.
Think about a military culture, you would have had some strong, good leaders.
And she's looking at me when she says that, by the way. So, but that's right. That was probably one of our greatest strengths is we had very strong leadership coming out of a military background, people who had lots of leadership ability and experience. What would have been some of our weaknesses?
Your legacy.
Our legacy. Now, how do you mean that, Larry? You can't say it both ways unless you explain.
Well, one of the weaknesses of legacy is kind of here. We've always done it that way. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, exactly right. And we're going to get to that very strongly in the next section. And it has to do with something I'm going to say about 50 times, is understanding the concept of mental maps. What else?
No previous experience in the area in which you're trying to make something happen.
Yes. Okay, good. Right. There's a big difference between leading in the military where this says this versus in the Navigators, which is essentially a voluntary organization. It hasn't always acted like a voluntary organization, but it is essentially a voluntary organization. Okay, what else is a weakness that some of you might remember? Yes.
Disconnected from one location to the other.
Yes, there was no connectivity in the place where we're doing the work. Very, very big weakness, yes.
One thing that I saw was it seemed like the Navigators tended to begin to put more focus on the collegiate and less on the military.
Leadership had made some strategic decisions that actually contributed to hindering our work in the military. Good. What else?
I have a question.
Certainly.
Why couldn't you do both things and do both things well if you had strong leadership? Why would saying, you know, they're focusing on collegiate, did that mean that they didn't focus at all on military?
And we'll get to that a little down, I think, in step four, allocation of resources. When you make strategic decisions, and we'll get to this in just a minute, when you make strategic decisions, you also make decisions about allocation of resources. Hey, if you want me to get you a Bible verse, I will. But resources will often tell you how successful a venture is going to be. That allocation of resources will, in fact, determine, in some cases, how effectively you can carry out your plan.
That's how a general fights a war.
Pardon me?
That's how a general fights a war.
That's exactly right. Okay, I'm going to move on here, but I'll say one weakness that you all haven't jumped on, which some of us remember, is a morale issue. And that was part of the idea that the military was not maybe as high a priority created, and I'm not going to go into this, nor it's more complicated than the way I'm going to describe it, but a morale problem, and a morale problem in a volunteer organization creates a whole cascade of problems. And one of those problems had to do with age of staff. And so we had an aging staff, and our recruiting was nil. Now, this is a larger systemic issue that took place throughout the Navigators and really throughout all Christian organizations through the 80s and 90s. We call it the lost generation, where for a number of reasons, that generation that began to get into the 20s and 30s, in the 80s and 90s, we didn't recruit those people. They didn't come on board. And as a product of that, our growth went flat. And when you are growth flat and your recruiting is non-existent, what happens to your workforce? It dwindles. Exactly right. And when your workforce dwindles, what happens to your capacity to accomplish the mission? It really decreases significantly. So, we were in a bind. I'll just say that. It's a significant bind.
That's a big word.
Bind? Yeah.
Consider. Is that where the MBO came in?
Pardon?
Where the
MBO was a part of the strategic solution in the idea of going back to God and asking God, what is it you want us to do? The scriptural roots of ministry was kind of like the
new FOM.
Yes, yes. The MBO actually says this is how you operate. We figured out, no, it didn't operate that well. Or it has consequences that we don't like. So from that, we went to the scriptural roots of ministry that helped us say, okay, this is probably the way God wants us to operate. So anyway, moving on, we saw those threats and opportunities. The major threat being we're going to cease to exist. Huge threat. Now, I'm not understating that. The very real possibility existed that our military ministry and other ministries and the Navigators would become irrelevant. It could not necessarily cease to exist, but cease to do what the Navigators had been called to do by God. I'm trying not to overstate that, but you know, those of us who are trying to figure out where to go and how to do it, we're under enormous pressure to do something, as my grandpa used to say, even if it was wrong. we're going to get over that problem. Though. So we began to develop possible strategies. And when we began to develop and build up the military ministry, which started in 91, we looked at several different strategies. We developed a strategy that had to do with lots of leaders. We had a strategy that had to do with developing a leadership around branches. We had a strategy that we ended up with, which was simply very flat. In other words, you had a leadership and then you had everybody else. Very few leaders. That's the model we actually went with. Now, why do you suppose we went with that model?
Resource allocation.
Resource allocation, exactly right. That's one of them. What's another reason?
Morale's low. It's
yes.
Very difficult to lead people that don't want to be led.
That's right. That's right. You have to, in the interim, produce a key element that you cannot make progress without. And that element is?
Trust.
Yeah, trust. You can't lead without trust. Can't lead without trust. So that interim period was a period in which a few leaders were trying to rebuild the trust element in the work and also to create a new a new respect for leadership, which had kind of floated away somewhere. I'm not sure where it went to. That's my computer doing a little wind sound there. So I thought that'd be really cool, but it sounds kind of funny. So, step four, establish a strategic objectives. I've talked a little bit about what we did. We decided we needed to have a flat leadership structure. That was one of our objectives. We needed to... What's another strategic objective that you can envision we had to come up with?
How to recruit staff.
How to recruit staff, yes. I was on the original red team, you know, recruiting something and something. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. But recruiting was number one objective. What's another critical objective? Also having to do with resource allocation. Funding. Funding the mission. I mean, how are we supposed to fund it? One of the ways that we funded it, this is back in the early days, Rusty Stevens, who was the director, actually was the director and the secretary. So we ran the mission on, you talking about a shoestring. Oh, my goodness. Then as our funding strategies began to develop, we began to see more funds come in. What was some of you that have been around a while, what was one of the most strategic funding objectives?
CFC.
Something that's, pardon? CFC, exactly right. So, Combined Federal Campaign. We weren't involved in the Combined Federal Campaign when we first started up the mission. Nobody had even thought about it. So as we began to think about, well, what are some ways, and this is actually how it happened, during CFC time, a chaplain came up to me and says, why aren't the navigators in CFC? And I says, oh, no. So at that point, we said, you know, that sounds like a pretty good idea. And as we began to develop that, we actually were enabled to begin doing resource allocation that allowed us to do some things that we had never been able to do before. Number five. Well, I didn't go over SMART measures and timelines, but that's just, SMART is specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, yeah, and time frame. That's just a means by which you look at how to put together an objective. Use that little acronym to help you decide, okay, is this something that's narrow enough that we can understand what it is? Simple enough. Can we decide when we've done it or when it's working? Is it realistic in the fact that it can be completed? Is it actually pie in the sky by and by, or is it actually something that we can accomplish? And then ultimately, anything you want to accomplish, you've got to put a timeline on it. If you don't put a timeline on it, the flow of life will move you right past. All right, strategic execution plan. Weak implementation versus proper deployment plan. What would a weak implementation plan be look like? What are some characteristics of weak implementation plans of strategy and strategic objectives?
Poor communication.
Poor communication. That is excellent, Joseph.
No buy-in.
Good. What's a critical one? If everybody's in charge, nobody's in charge. Weak implementation almost always centers around a lack of clarity of who's responsible. I'm going to move on because the real good part of this is coming. I promise you. Just stay where you are. Of course, as packed in as you're not going to get out anyway. So, yeah. Okay, establish resource allocation. Minimum resources mean minimum accomplishment. I have a job, or I had a job, I'm on sabbatical now, I'm not supposed to be doing anything, but just because I love you so, I'm in here. I had a job called, I'm the leader of the cross-missional team for the Southeast and the Navigators. Now, this is a wonderful job in which they have given me no money to operate on, no authority to tell anybody what to do. And besides, I had to stack it on everything else I was doing. So what does that sound like? Minimum resources. And if I wasn't such a good guy, I probably would have done a terrible job. But I, you know, I'm just a wonderful person and, you know, all that. Yeah. And humble too. Exactly right. That's one of my primary characteristics, remember. So minimum resources always means work overload for individuals. When I think of work overload, I always think of Chuck. Because at one time he was leading the army and leading the training, and I'd given him all those jobs, and you know, I felt a little guilty, but he's doing such a good job that I thought, oh well, we hadn't got to overload yet. And then what happened, Chuck? There was a meltdown. Yeah, it was an overload. And, you know, I'm laughing, but it was really sad for me. Now, we have to believe in the sovereignty of God, right? That God was doing something and all that. But that's what happens when you have minimum resources and work overload for an individual. It causes the system and the process of your execution can come to a stop. Step 7, execution review. That's what happens when you're going to hang a guy and you get a bunch of people just to make sure the hanging goes right. Actually, it really means that you inspect what you expect. Now, this is an old saying that we've all known for many, many years, but it's always true. If you're not looking at what you want your outcome to be, then you won't get it. Now, if you get it, it will be more random or just because of people's really good efforts. It won't be because the plan actually worked. All plans have to have constant review. Why?
Things change.
That we can be sure of. Things change. Environment changes. People change. What else?
Threats and opportunities change.
Threats and opportunities change. Excellent. What else?
Sometimes you have bad evaluation criteria. You need to change that.
Exactly right. Sometimes what you are using to make that review is just not the right stuff. Quite often what will happen is, you know, people change. You may have someone who's been very, very good in a particular job, and you ask them to do this job, and lo and behold, what do you discover? That they're not very good at that job. They didn't like it to begin with, they told you.
Also, circumstances change at the war.
Sure. Very good, very good. Yeah, circumstances. One of the things on that topic, by the way, which I think is very illustrative, is in the military ministry in the 80s, what was true? We weren't at war. And so our mindset for developing models of military ministry was based on people who were there. Then guess what happened? We went to war, and then the war didn't last that long. But, you know, for the last 9 years, we've been in a war that continues. And all of us who are in military ministry knows what happens. Your people come and they go. They come back, but then they go again real quick. And they come back and then they go again. And so your model has got to change if you are still thinking about, well, I just have this ministry and we'll work with these people. You've got to begin thinking, how is the environment different? Let me just tell you, there is a number one here. Here's what number one would have said. An organization changes only as far or as fast as its collective individuals change. Organization in or top down is no substitute for individual out or bottom up. To strategically change your or any organization, you must first change the individual. Now, how often have you seen that applied? Well, you can speak up. Most of the time, what is the process of changing strategically?
Top down,
and what does that mean exactly?
You have to change the people.
That the leaders have said, here's where we're going. And you all must go there. And I have to, in fact, plead guilty to that charge. So there, it's out. That's the way authoritarian or even authoritative leadership structures work. The leaders have the big vision, and then their job is to get the followers to move into a place where they'll be fruitful and productive and happy and all the rest. And without contacting or involving the grassroots or the workers or ever how you want to describe it, what happens is, bam, you hit a block. Now, you can work on that block and you can take picks out and sledgehammers and all the rest. But I'm proposing that there is a better way to do this. There really is. So, number two means unlocking change starts and ends with mental maps people carry in their heads. And that mental map tells them how they see themselves, their organization, the job that they do. So, this is an important concept for everything we're going to talk about, the mental map. What do we have mental maps on? What's that?
How to do ministry.
Exactly right.
Who we are in Christ.
We have mental maps about that.
Mental maps about marriage. Mental maps about what community you live in. Mental maps about what you wear.
Yes.
What you don't wear. What you buy. All kind of cars. You got mental maps about everything.
We got a mental map about everything. Let me give it to you, share a story with you. I live in Chapel Hill, and I've got this guy that I meet with on Tuesday mornings at a coffee shop. Every Tuesday morning, I get up, drive down the 5 miles to the coffee shop. Best coffee in the universe. Wonderful. In case you ever come to Chapel Hill, I'll take you there. So I get up, drive there. It takes me probably, when it's worker bee traffic time, 20 minutes. So I get up one morning, I get down there. They're working on the road. And so I'm sitting in gridlock, you know. We've all done this. Finally get there. It's taken me 35 minutes to go that 5 miles. So the next Tuesday, I jump in my car and do what? I go the same way. Now, why did I go the same way? Mental map. Mental map says, I've got a man-to-man, and it's going to be at this place. And I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to go there. And my mental map says, okay. Next Tuesday, guess what happens? Same thing. But this time, those of you who know me well will really appreciate this. When I see the line, I pull over the median and go back the other way and then drive through town and save myself about 10 minutes. Then the next time, I avoid the traffic gap. But that's what I mean by a mental map. Mental maps really determine how we're going to think about something. And it's not, oh, well, I think this will be my mental map today. It's ingrained by habit and by values. Principle 2 or 3, whoosh, leaders cannot change individuals' mental maps. They will not change the destinations people pursue or the paths they take to get there. What is that called? When the leaders have said, we're going there. And the leaders say, I mean, the followers say, oh yeah, we're going there. But then don't. Well, it's not mutiny. Now, what is it?
Rebellion.
Well, you'd call it rebellion, but it's usually reflected in passive-aggressive kinds of behaviors. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm going there, but I'm really not. You can tell me I'm going there, and I'll tell you I'm going there, but I'm really not. Has anybody ever been exposed to that? Has anybody ever done that? Of course, that's a human condition. So, if that be the case, successful strategic change requires a focus on individuals and redrawing, helping them redraw those mental maps that they have. Leading, this is really, really so important. Leading strategic change requires becoming an effective mental cartographer or map maker. In other words, a leader has got to understand that mental maps are what drive people. And the job of leadership is not telling people where to go. The job of leadership is helping them find the way. And that is, and when we think about the title of this workshop, Leading Strategic Change, all three of those words are loaded with meaning. Leading in our context has to do with the ability to understand what it means to serve people. So leadership in our context is primarily about serving. Secondly, strategic means the ability to see the big picture and do what's required to execute in order that the big picture becomes reality. So what is our big picture statement as navigators? Go ahead, Chuck. Now, wait a minute. You know that verse. Go ahead.
You talk about
it. Yes.
To advance the gospel of Jesus into the nations and the spiritual generations, living and laboring among the lost.
Yes.
Living
and discipling among the lost. Yeah. Living and discipling. So that's our big picture. That's our big picture. And so when I come to Spang Dahlem, you know, Vernon there, Larry's there now. I say, guys, how are we doing in advancing the gospel of the kingdom?
Terrible.
You're not there. Easy for you to say. So, why am I doing that? Well, I'm going to be real simplistic here and kind of a little bit ironic, but I don't want to go there and hear Vernon or Larry or whoever say, we're knowing Christ and making Him known, you know. That's not what I'm looking for. When I go and ask Him, well, how are we doing in advancing the gospel of Jesus and His kingdom? I'm trying to help these guys get a mental map. I'm trying to let develop in them a contrast of, okay, the difference between what Chuck just described and to know Christ and make Him known. I want to make a contrast there. And in addition, I'm going to confront them. Now, I'm not going to beat them up, but I'm going to, every time I come, guess what I'm going to ask them? Go ahead, Jesse. Yeah, you had your hand up, or I don't
know. No. I was just scratching.
Mm. Okay. Well, fortunately, I don't have to come to Camp Lejeune and do that anymore. Fun. So, you see what I'm saying? The job of the leader is not to beat people down until they behave correctly. The job of the leader is to help them develop this image, this picture, that allows them to get where they need to go. We're going to talk about that. Maybe. But you know, life is difficult, isn't it? There are problems in life. Things happen that are not on your script or mine. And fortunately, though, those kind of happenings and hindrances are common to all of us. And so it's not like you get unique stuff. You just get the stuff that happens to everybody. So there are barriers that prevent substantial change or sustainable change. And we have, there's three questions. You know, probably I'm going to remember a whole lot here, and that'd be all right. But you remember these three questions. And these three questions will help you immensely, especially if you can put the answers with these three questions. These are called brain barriers. And I don't know what happened to that brain barrier. I guess it was me. Oh, I got it doing that fancy stuff here. I realize that. When opportunities or threats stare us in the face, do we, we're all set up for this, fail to see the need of change? Now, can any of you envision a situation where that was true of you, or true of the people around you, or true maybe even of the leaders who were leading you? Situation changes in life. The situation is no longer what it used to be. But nobody seems to say, oh, we need to change. What is usually the first response? Pardon? Yeah, we've always done it this way, and yes, we got to work harder. We just need to work harder. If we work harder, it'll work out. No, sorry, sometimes working harder just doesn't work. Take it from an expert who tried working harder all his life. Even when the need is seen, Yeah, I see that, but I'm not too sure I want to go there. Why? Why don't I want to go there if I see the need?
There's a chance of failure.
Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about this a little bit more. Why would I want to go somewhere if I know I'm competent doing the wrong thing, but doing the right thing means I'm going to be incompetent, at least for a while? Why would I want to go to incompetency? Most of us just really, really resist change based on the idea that I've got to go from what I'm good at to what I'm not going to be very good at. And then even when we fail, when we move, we just don't finish it because we don't go far enough or we don't go fast enough. And we'll talk about some of the hindrances there. So any thoughts on this, on these three barriers to working strategic change?
Well, this could be a mental map that took us years based on leadership to do wrestling with a mental map we've had for years.
Yes, exactly. Most of us, when we're about the process of strategic change, are dealing with mental maps that we've had for many years. So I maybe not get into it too much, but in the 70s, when the Navigators were, Joe mentioned, doing our leadership by management by objective, what was the mental map that was driving that idea?
Corporate business model.
Yes, it was a corporate business model that said, you know, if you do these things will result. Well, so why did anybody buy that? Because in that time, in the corporate world, it worked. It worked. Why wouldn't you buy it? Well, we won't go into why you won't buy that, but let me just say that when people have experience in a process that works, even when it begins not to work, it's very hard to move away from that model. That's the way we are as human beings. Wrong maps, failing to see the need for change. So, can any of you think of a wrong map? I've given you an example of a wrong map I've had. Does anybody want to share a wrong map that they've had that's caused them to fail to see the need for change? Of course, none of you.
Is that what Kim was talking about in the main sessions?
Well, and yes, okay, and clarify that a little bit.
Well, he's talking about the chamber.
full gospel or diminished gospel. Emphasis on evangelism, the whole idea of being converted. Everything he's saying got her.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. Talking about a change in our mental map about the movement of the gospel. The issue, regardless of all the other stuff that, you know, might be stuck in heads, the issue here is the movement of the gospel. And so what are the maps that we have that actually, though we don't think of it this way, are hindrances to the movement of the gospel? We won't go into his discussion, but for us in the military, one of our mental maps was that we needed regions in order that staff would be together, that they would have fellowship, that would have encouragement, and so forth and so on. So to move away from that picture required a great deal of processing. Now, maybe some people don't believe that was the wrong map, but having said that, if Chuck had failed to see the need, and his mental map was, we're doing just fine at Fort Benning, what could I do as a leader to help Chuck get the picture, get the right map? I'm sorry, I'm picking Chuck out. Believe me, that wasn't his mental map. So he just happened to be sitting on the front row.
We're to assess the stated outcome of what it is you're really trying to accomplish.
Okay, good, good. Mike.
Well, often when you have regions, you become focused, you become microscopic, focusing on what you do. So you look at your target, and you look at your target being more important than the people. Trying to read, so you're not focused on the laborers, but you're focused on your target.
Okay. What's one implicit idea that we believed about this idea that helped sustain this wrong mental map? I shouldn't be fishing on you. I'll just give you the answer I said. One of the things that we believed was that a navigator could do everything that a person needed in order to get them to be a lifetime laborer. That particular navigator. Chuck could do it all. Mike could do it all. Vern, Larry, they could do it all. So they didn't need anybody else. That mental map was a wrong map. Because what we experienced was, you know, as good a guy as he is, he couldn't do it all. As good a disciple of men as Mike is, he couldn't do it all. So we needed to change that map to help them see that by flowing our friends throughout their military experience from one place to another, they would get inputs that they would never get in just one place. And therefore, the adding and the multiplication of that impact of development helped a person get closer to this goal of a lifetime labor. Okay, the power of gravity keeps us from seeing impending threats and opportunities. What is the power of gravity? Kevin said it. What's the power of gravity, Kevin? We always have done it this way. That's a gravity statement. Now, I don't want to ridicule anybody who's ever said that, because you know it's a natural idea. I mean, we did it this way; it worked. Why would you change it?
That's kind of like building a man to follow our pain. We've always done it this way.
Yes, yes. So, as somebody asked Kim, well, why don't you have a Billy Graham crusade, you know, in Saudi Arabia? Yeah, we laugh about that, but you know, if you think, well, people go to crusades, they hear the gospel, they get saved. Why wouldn't you go to Saudi Arabia with it? I mean, just based on that mental map, you see what I'm saying? Well, it was perfectly logical to go to Saudi Arabia. Fortunately, Billy Graham and the associations realized there's a little bit more to it than that. So, The power of a flawed map. The longer the map works, the harder it is to change. A flawed map doesn't mean that it isn't working at all. It just means that it's not the best possible solution. And if it's not the best possible solution, you will hold on to it much harder than if you think, oh, well, this isn't really working. Okay.
I'll say this, the older we get, sometimes that their knowledge is harder to change and it gets set in the way it works.
That's the power of gravity.
Yeah. But I like the power of love. So, yeah, you know what I was thinking about. Mike knows me very well, so.
I think to do that when you're leading change, Phil, you're gonna laugh when I say this, but you have to know your people, and that some people change is harder for others. Just by the nature of how God designed them.
I have to tell a story on Pam on this very issue. You know, we're having a discussion at the MLT meeting. So when Pam first came on the MLT. And Pam and I were actually on different sides of this discussion, you know. And it was a very, I don't know, passionate discussion. Would you say passionate, Pam?
It wasn't vociferous or whatever that.
No, it wasn't mean. Twas not mean-spirited, but it was passionate. So, and we're, after the meeting's over, we're driving away, you know, going to dinner. And what did you say, Pam? You said?
I said, Phil, are we okay? Because we've been friends for a real long time.
Yeah.
Like, are we okay?
And I said, what? It just never occurred to me, you know, that would be an issue. But for Pam, whose values would be centered around harmony and stability, it was kind of like, I don't know what's going on. Are we okay? So that's. I'm not saying that's a flawed map, but that's how that idea works. So, all right, the keys to seeing. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Joe.
So you said changes are not, it's not that you change everything, but you can't just make a total change. But whatever you're doing is right.
Right. Well, so now what we're talking about, Joe, we're not talking about turning things upside down. What we're talking about is thinking of strategic change. So, and that's a wonderful question and insight. Even in strategic change, we might not change some of our tactics. So, for example, we're in a very significant strategic change in the military ministry. If you didn't know that, just let me let you know that we are. But guess what? We are still getting people into the TMS, are we not? We are still teaching people that when you get up in the morning, you ought to read your Bible. So tactical changes aren't necessarily a part of the strategic change process. There may be some tactical changes that take place, but just because we are thinking about strategic change doesn't mean that everything changes.
Your approach is cold-hearted. That's not follow-up.
Right.
Insider.
Right. And again, what you're talking about a tactical issue. And that's a change process that comes along with our understanding of how the gospel advances. So the strategic idea is we want to advance the gospel of Jesus and His kingdom into the nations through spiritual generations who live and disciple among the lost. Now, in that strategic idea, there are many, many different ways we want. Some of them we want to change. Now, guess what? I happen to think there's still room, regardless of what our brothers have said this morning that may lead you otherwise, there's still room for telling people about Jesus in a very structured way, maybe that you don't even know. Alan Andrews, who used to be the president of Navigators, would always try to talk to people about Jesus on the airplane. People that he would never see before. Again, rather. Never see him again. He's always about doing that. And those of us who, not me, but those of you who have the more evangelistic bent, will often find ways of just moving right into a person's life with with your understanding of the gospel. So, back to slide number 99 here, whatever it is. The keys to seeing. How do you see? Understand, the first barrier is you just don't see the need for change. The way to get through that barrier is for the leader or those who are involved in the change process to create contrasts. Now, what I mean by creating contrast. What does a contrast do in terms of your vision? What is a contrast? When I say contrast, when you're looking at something, what does contrast do when you're looking at it? It highlights things. It highlights things. It causes you to say, well, no, that's actually aqua. That's not... It's one of those other strange colors that women always know about and men never do. Fuchsia! Yeah. So, an effective leader who is committed to understanding and processing strategic change will help create these contrasts for people so that they'll see, okay, here's this. Which do you think is going to be best for us? And so if it's really the way that you ought to go, usually that contrast helps a person get down the road. The second thing is, and I mentioned this about going to Spank Dolom, is confrontation. And that confrontation is confronting with those contrasts. It's not about yelling at Vernon or, getting up in Jesse's face about something. Confrontation is really about going back to and back to and back to. Now, I use the example of Germany because when I would go there, Vern, I don't know whether you remember this, when you guys first got there and I began to come and visit you, what was it that I was trying to get to you guys on? What was it? What did you understand I was trying to help you understand? Mm-hmm. That's right. Establishing foundational ministry. Very good. Thank you for saving me on that. Okay. He's on my side too, is he? All right. Good. But so, these guys are starting a new ministry. And they just come out of staff training. And so, I'm not sure they understand everything there is to do about what foundations are in a navigator ministry. So I come in, I ask them questions. You know, in asking them questions, I'm thinking, you know, contrasting what they may be doing right now with what they need to be doing without telling them, hey, why aren't you doing what I told you to do? Which, you know, I might have done a time or two, but probably not. In our last 2 or 3 years in the military ministry, those of you who have been involved in it, some of us have been involved in a traveling dog and pony show. And what has that dog and pony show been about? Hey, somebody was listening. But the point is, the leadership, in order to produce a strategic change in the way people were thinking about ministry, decided the way to go was to go and confront that. Now, we didn't do it in a mean way, especially after we learned a few lessons about it. But to go and to have a conversation with our staff and laborers. Chuck was wonderful in helping me understand the difference between telling and conversing on this subject. He really was. He helped me understand that, you know, if the bottom up, the people in the grassroots, said this is what we want to hear about, and we responded to that, we still got to tell them what we wanted to. Right, Chuck? And that's not manipulative. That's smart. That's confronting with contrast. Okay. Got to move on here. The second brain barrier is the failure to move. The old right thing is now wrong. Don't know what to do. Don't know what the new right thing is. Or don't know how to do the right thing. Now, let's just say you see that the old thing isn't working anymore, but you don't know how to do the right thing. Do you want to change without knowing what the new right thing is? Do you want to? I had a little illustration. I don't have time to draw it up here. But most of us would rather stay in the place where we're doing the wrong thing well than to go to the new right thing and do it very poorly. Because it's humiliating to do things very poorly. So that's a huge problem. Okay, here's how to get around that. The key to moving, the promising path. So here we go, traveling around the U.S. and Europe, talking about this great new way to think about ministry. We call the six critical factors of a multiplying ministry. When we begin to talk about this, we begin to engage, we begin to converse about this, guess what happens? People begin to see the direction that we need to go in. They begin to see the place we need to get to. What's the place we need to get to when we're talking about critical factors of ministry? What is it?
Generations.
Now, is a navigator staff, is his objective to do Bible study with people?
Yes and no.
What? Well, but is it his objective? No. His objective is not Bible study. Bible study is what? A tool. It's a means. Now, don't go away here thinking I'm saying you shouldn't do Bible study. Of course you should. But what we're trying to do is create a path for people, a promising path that says this is the way to get to generations. Now, some folks have had struggles with getting to generations. And part of that struggle is because they haven't been on the right path. They have not understood maybe some of the things that are absolutely necessary to get there. One of the most important aspects of getting to generations is what, Vernon? you were thinking, I know. When we're talking about getting to this end, which we call generations, the promising path to get there, one of those means of getting there is what? Building foundations. Building foundations. Okay. So, here's a key word here. Believing. Helping others gain belief in this path and destination. If you don't do that, then why would somebody want to change? So the key for a leader, and you don't have to be an inspirational leader to do that. You just have to be able to, as a leader, understand where it is you're going, and you have to clearly articulate to people how to get there. Mike is wonderful at doing this. He makes things practical. He's a tool guy. So he can help young people understand that, oh yeah, I know you want to go here, but you know what? You've got to make sure that this works, this works, this works. Okay, give them skills, resources, and tools to reach destination. All right. Final brain barrier to strategic change is failure to finish. And we get two reasons for failing to finish. You get tired and you get lost. Sometimes you get tired and somebody might tell you to get lost. Hear a little drum beat there. All of us have been tired, in ministry. Those of us who have been in ministry for a long time. Sometimes you just think, man, I don't know whether I can do another iteration of this. But my high school football coach used to say, and this is a great cliche, but it's cliche as cliches are, it's often true. When the going gets tough, tough get going. That's right. And if we're going to get to the good end, a lot of times the Lord leads us through what? The wilderness of Zen. Sometimes it is God's way for us to get tired and to get lost in order that we might depend on Him. Keys to finishing. Even when you, particularly when you're tired and particularly when you're lost, you need champions and charting. Now, what is a champion? Here's what a champion is. A champion is someone who understands it, knows where you need to go, and has the path. And most often, that is not the person in the top leadership. When we're trying to affect a strategic change in the military mission, you know who had the greatest leverage in that? Who was it, Mike?
The examples, the models.
Yes, and who were doing that?
Those are the same spiritual generations who come from the favor of God.
Exactly right. And I would say that in order for us to move the organization and to get to the place where we got more and more acceptance of the strategic change, we had to have people in the field who were doing it and who were champions of that change. So Andrew Stroud, for example, was a guy who was really living it. And he even did certain things that modeled what it would be like if we were there. Chuck Wood was another guy who's out there modeling, working through the problems that inevitably come when you have that sort of strategic change. Mike Darnell got the reputation of being, what was it, Mike? Being a bridge builder. Being a bridge builder. So one of the functions of a champion is a bridge builder, which is about what charting is. What a champion and what leaders are doing is they are charting, clearing out the rubble and helping people see here's how we get there. And if you do these things, it will be a great end. Champions are where the rubber meets the road, which usually means right there where the action takes place, not necessarily just at the leadership, upper leadership level. Launch sites is where you see this thing happen. So launch sites are not bases or posts necessarily. They're where the thing that you want to see happen is happening and the people that are doing it. All right, I'm going to move on because we're almost out of time. Barriers, seeing, moving, finishing. Solutions or remapping, conceiving, believing, achieving. So, you know, I've just wasted about 87 minutes of your time to give you six words that will help you always understand the process of leading strategic change. The leader sees the barriers. He helps people move who don't understand or desire to move necessarily, and he helps them finish it. And he does it by conceiving of what the solutions are, and then helping those who are expected to execute the changes to believe. And then by helping them get there, by achieving it.
Bill, it might be helpful to some people in here if you just gave them the mat right quick. Take your little thing, draw your foundation, do the six critical factors, little map, and let them see that.
Okay, as an example. As an example. I will do that, Mike. Thank you. That's not part of it. Okay, I like to start at the end. The end is generations.
Actually, Jesse can come up with
daughter. Actually,
Jesse what? I said Jesse can come up with daughter. He doesn't do it backwards.
Okay, so one generation shall proclaim him to another. That is what we're about. One generation, your generation, shall proclaim him to the next generation. So, how do we get to those generations? Well, where do we start? Vernon, where do we start?
Foundations.
I knew you'd get that. Vernon, foundations. What are the foundations? Mike? Three P's.
Prayer.
Start it with foundational prayer. And foundational prayer gets us to promises. Standing on the promises, right? And our promises are always literally about foundational people. Some shape or form or another. Okay. Once we... now, listen. realizing that what Mike is getting at, this is not necessarily always taking place in this progressive way. But if we're talking about starting new, beginning something, this is the way we begin. These are the processes that need to take place. So once we're working on these foundations, what is that going to create for us? All right, we're running out of time. I will not let you answer. It's going to create a team. So we move towards generation, not simply on, I can do this by myself, but because we have a team of people who are committed to getting there. Okay. What is our foundation that begins us in the process of kingdom work that moves in generations? I wish I could spell and write at the same time. Reaching the lost. Yes. Implicit in reaching the lost is that we understand the gospel. Okay. As we reach the lost,
disciple this generation.
Yeah, we do. In order to get to this generation outward, we have to disciple this generation. Our discipling process produces what? Labors and leaders. All this takes place in the context of what?
Community is supposed to be before labors.
Well, it is, but I'm just saying, as this process is taking place, it's taking place in the context of kingdom, communities. I got that one good. C-O-M-M, period. That's what we have been in the Navigators working from as a model for significant mental map. Good. Strategic change. This is our mental map. This is the good place that we want the Navigator mission to get to. And we don't have time to talk about how vision works and all that. Okay, it's time to go. So I want to let you go. Thanks for your time. Any final, oh, by the way, just burning questions?
I have a comment. And I think you were speaking about it, but I didn't hear it directly. And there were some foundational changes. One of the ministries I'm affiliated with, and one of the things they kept doing was kept coming back to this and kept talking about this. Here's where we are, and they kept on drawing the map in front of us. So part of, I think, what you're sharing about the conceiving and believing is imparting the vision through the various levels and then keep on communicating it. Is that what I'm getting from this conceiving?
Once the vision is conceived, the confrontation of continual restoring this idea to people is what produces believing. Conceiving is just the idea of seeing what the problem is. Believing is when you have folks on board who believe where you need to go and are willing to go. In other words, if I was drawing the little map I had, I didn't have time to draw out. It would be going from doing the right thing well, doing the wrong thing well, to the right thing poorly. That's the next step. Now, you don't always have to do it poorly. You might be able to get to the right thing and do it the right way. But the point is, as you conceive of the idea, you have to help people believe that that will really be where they need to go. Okay. Any other burning questions? Okay.
I just want to make a quick statement real quick.
Right.
I often need things to be put into layman's terms, so I'm just going to suggest a good book that I think really parallels with this. So I'll call Who Moved My Cheese.
Oh, yeah.
I may have read that.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of purpose, it reminded me about that book. Which...
Okay, yeah. Well, actually, this whole thing comes out of a book called, ironically, Leading Strategic Change. But yeah. About that. Any other questions? All right, let me pray for us and we'll be out of here. Lord, help us to hear your voice and obey your leading, that we might glorify your name and your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen.